can tell this, but I am centered. I'm serene.
Yeah, there is something especially zen about you today. What's going on?
Well, I'll tell you what's going on. I had the pleasure of going with Ben on a 24-hour yoga and breathwork retreat. Okay.
Oh.
In Santa Monica, California, sponsored by an app called Open. Now, here's the thing. I think if you're searching the App Store, which you should, I think it's like O-P-E-N is the official name. Because if you search for Open, what comes up is a dating service for three ways, which is not, it's not the same as this wellness app. But it was, it's a new wellness app that is sort of, it's wellness based, but it's a little on the Peloton model of like there are live classes and you can, you know, if you're doing yoga, you can have your camera on so the person can, you know, critique your form or whatever. It's a really cool app. But anyway, they took, it was like a media trip. They took a bunch of people to the proper hotel in Santa Monica, and it was like 24 hours of like sound baths and breath work sessions. I'd never done breath work before, Matt. Have you done breath work?
I don't know. I guess so. I mean, I breathe.
Okay. See, I breathe too. But breath work, very different thing. You're like, we were on the ground on yoga mats, and you breathe in like and fill up your, you do like diaphragmatic breathing.
Yeah.
So you fill up your belly, then you fill up your chest, and then you release it all out. And you do it like to a beat, to the beat of live music in this case, over the course of like 10 minutes. And then it was like mushrooms, like fully, it took me mentally, physically to a different space. Was there screaming involved? Yes, there was. There was a moment where it was just like scream at the top of your lungs, which I did, and I left my body for a moment. It was really, really something else. I'm into breath work now. That's my thing.
I'm fascinated. And so you're screaming at the top of your lungs at the end of the breath work period?
In the middle.
In the middle.
Yeah. There were maybe 12 of us in a studio. Was it in Venice? Yes, of course it was.
Of course.
But yeah, all of us just like screaming. There was a gong. There was, you know, live percussion. It was incredible. And then, of course, out for a vegan dinner with the gang from the app, all of whom are unbelievably beautiful, right? Like next level beautiful. And just like serene and cool. And I was like, who's the Keith? A little bit, like, because this might be a cult, and I might be interested, and I'm, you know, I'm wondering where the tattoo will eventually go, but I'm willing to put it on me. Truly, truly life-changing. 24 hours of yoga and breath work.
God,
I mean, you know,
me
probably eight of it was sleep, but so 16 hours of yoga and breath work, and I'm a new man.
And this feeling, like the, almost like you were on mushrooms and that euphoria, did it stay with you after the session was over?
It actually did. Like all through that dinner, Ben and I both were like, "Do you feel awesome?" And we did. It was really great. I'm a convert. It took me nearly 20 years, but I have gone full LA. I do breath work now.
Welcome.
I do.
I guess
music.
I have to. Why am I acting like I don't know what this is talking about? I was a fucking theater major at NYU. All I did was lie on the floor and breathe and cry for 4 years, you know?
Oh, that's great. God.
Not to brag.
Yeah. Love it. Open. O-P-E. Whatever. Just do a search for like Open Wellness. You'll find it. It'll come up. If you end up on the three-way app, you know, whatever. Have fun. Do you.
Get both Open apps. Why don't you?
Why not? Why not? Do it with a friend. Do it with a third. How's your week?
Just as boring as ever, as usual. Coming into this intro, an empty husk with nothing to contribute. But we did just complete this week's interview.
Yes,
with,
we did.
Your dear friend, and now I'm gonna say it, my new friend, Mike Doyle.
The world, yeah. I mean, to know Mike Doyle is to love Mike Doyle. He is a human being of just pure charm and eloquence. I loved him from the moment I met him. He is the CEO of Ketchum, which is a massive PR firm. He is now on the board of directors of GLAAD. Maybe not the board of. He's on the board of GLAAD.
He's on the board of GLAAD.
And he's just one of these people who I think is truly, truly remarkable. And I am always thrilled to introduce him to people, and I am now thrilled to introduce him to all of you. However, there were technical difficulties.
Yeah,
all of us, each of us came in to this Zoom with our own internet baggage. Was it a laggy Wi-Fi? Was it a computer that is apparently held together by duct tape and dreams? Whatever it was, we each had a moment of utter Wi-Fi chaos. So please be patient and listen all the way through, because it's worthwhile. It's worth getting through the difficult internet times that we had. And as I say this, Matt McConkie is frozen. I say this, and Matt McConkie is frozen. We are all, God, we're just barely hanging on. I'm telling you, folks. All right, listen, the Wi-Fi hates us, but we love you, and we love Mike Doyle. Listen to him and get the full experience.
I was frozen until this very moment. So whatever whatever happened, whatever you said, I stand by it. And let's go to the interview.
Mike Doyle, you're in Asbury Park, I have to assume.
I can go one further than that. I am I am 9.5 blocks from the Stone Pony.
Yeah, you are.
I know.
Are they doing concerts yet?
Tell me what the Stone Pony is.
Oh, the Stone Pony is a legendary rock venue where Bruce Springsteen got his start, and which has an excellent outdoor summer concert series. Which are they?
They are. Yeah, back in a really awesome creative way. So the summer stage is up. It's rolling, and they've created, instead of sort of a standing room only situation, they've got about, 50, 75 or so picnic tables. You know, the beer garden's open and all that stuff. So you reserve a table and you're with your friends and everybody's there, and it's working out. It's working out great.
I love it. Who's
just
playing?
Had a couple of Bruce cover bands.
Great.
You're going to be thrilled and intrigued. Cafferty. Oh, my God. What
John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band?
I think this weekend. Up on the marquee.
On the dark side?
I know.
Oh, yeah?
On the dark side. On the dark side.
Come on.
Which is, it's a big deal. Big deal for Asbury. Mm-hmm.
So for those who don't know, Asbury Park has become something of a more sensible Fire Island.
Depends
on
the
night.
Yeah,
that's what I'm hearing. It's not a place that you think of as like a thriving queer community, but what is the scene there?
Oh, I love the question. All credit to the pioneers of Asbury Park, and there are many. There were this town is for those of you, the good listeners who might not know the Jersey Shore as well. Asbury by car is like a 55-minute drive from the city. And so that's terrific, right? Instead of having to, take a helicopter and then, like a blimp and then a train and a cab to Fire Island or wherever you have to do that. 55 minutes by car, hour and 40 minutes by train. So that's attractive. Right about 2000, 2001, some really brave and terrific folks looked at Asbury, a town that had been, had let a lot of it kind of go, by the wayside. A lot of big, beautiful Victorian homes, these spectacular, 10 bedroom homes right off the beach. That is not where I'm coming to you from. But they said, what if we went down and gave this a shot and picked up a lot of houses and started to turn them and started to modernize them and all that stuff, and did that in concert with this incredibly beautiful, diverse, exciting, artistic community in a town. And they were already here. And so together, I think that sort of combined unity has created this resurgence in Asbury, and it's just unbelievable. Now it is, there's a thriving LGBTQ community, an amazing restaurant scene. The music scene has always been here, but it's such an awesome kind of melting pot of folks that wanted to get out of the city for either a weekend place or a place to actually live full time, married with a really rich, diverse community that is already here. So just I will tell you, we bought this place 11 years ago, we were not among the pioneers. We were among the lucky ones. And but we never thought it would be the sanctuary that it had to be for the past, 16, 18 months. It's been unbelievable. It's a great place.
Come to Asbury Park. Absolutely. Everybody come to Asbury Park. Has it been your COVID refuge? Did you escape the city and hang out?
We did. Oh my God. It was the Friday night, March 13th of 2020. Of course, everybody has their, I remember that weekend story. But it was that Friday night, and my husband Brett, Dave, whom you obviously know, I sort of shut down the office. He and I, believe it or not, I'm mortified and somewhat horrified to recall this. We went out to a bar and had dinner. Like, it was like, you just didn't know what the hell's going on. Woke up Saturday morning. We each packed like a duffel bag. I think I had two sweaters and some like socks, I don't know, and then I iPad charger, and we're like, all right, let's just go to the house and we'll see where this all goes. And I remained sitting in the same place that I was that Saturday, March 14th. Yeah, this became our sanctuary. Wow. Thank God.
Yeah, city life cannot have been easy in the last year and a half. I think back to if this had happened, when I was 26 and had three roommates in a railroad apartment on the Upper East Side or whatever, the idea of not ever being able to leave or whatever. I mean, that's good God.
We had, it's so funny that you say that. Like I think about the good folks that I work with at my agency, and I can't tell you how many times, as I'm sitting here, I'm looking out, we've got a perfectly lovely backyard and a deck, and I'm, 10 blocks to the beach and all these things. And once we sort of settled in and realized this was going to be for a while, we tried very hard to break into some routines, like end the day and head to the beach and walk on the boardwalk, even in the frigid, December and January temperature, just to make good use of the space. Or I would do conference calls and kind of do laps in the backyard just to be able to stay active and make me feel less guilty about the two bottles of wine that I would drink that night. But I would be on phone calls, right? With I work with a lot of young folks. The average age at my agency is about 27. And these were the, if you're in New York, if you're in LA, you're in DC, you're living with nine people in a one bedroom thing that you put up fake walls, right? They were desperate to get the hell out of there. They were desperate to once we could open up the offices and make them available, they were desperate to get out of there to get some space. So I tried so hard to empathize and make them feel loved and cared for in other ways, but it was tough. It was really, really tough. Particularly when, I love that New York is often described as, a place where you live in a tiny place because the city is your living room. Like, what does it say when your living room is shut down and you can't enjoy it, right? A whole part of your existence is so very lucky. Yeah. Never try to take this place for granted.
Yeah. So in your Asbury Park living room, what got you through? How did you soothe yourself culturally?
What a great question. Totally. Well, there's that. There's that.
Yeah.
That's why we're together, right? Isn't that we're going to explore my consumption issues, my wine.
This is an intervention. Yeah. Yeah. It's on tape. So yeah, you can get back to it.
Very one day at a time is how it feels, which is, is always your vibe. So in no respectable order, we went hard and remain so devotees of the America's Test Kitchen. Do you know America's Test Kitchen? Right?
Do I ever?
If you don't, you must. Like Bridget and Julia and their team of people, literally Dan Souza, with whom I'm obsessed. Like Brett and I cooked from there. We watched the show. It would keep me sane at night. Like there was something amazing about escaping into that. Was a huge salve for us.
Because they will go so deep. They will not only tell you the recipe, they will tell you why each ingredient is there, why it is that amount of each ingredient, what other things they tried and what the result was. Like it's very cooking was always sort of mystifying to me, but they make it very, very easy, very like, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, but they make it make sense in a way that made it more accessible to me.
I don't know that this has occurred to me until this very moment. I think one of the reasons maybe we loved it so much and I still do is it's like, I am not wired to do two things at once equally well. I pretend to try to multitask, but I can't. Like if I'm focused on something, then I'm disastrous on other stuff. So with what you do with America's Test Kitchen, like you have to follow those 67 steps that lead to perfection. So I couldn't do anything else. So maybe it kept me distracted in a way that was therapy that I didn't realize it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's so very immersive. It's very, very immersive. And I love not only do they give you great recipes, and also Cooks Illustrated. I'm sure you're a reader and or subscriber.
In all ways.
But in America's Test Kitchen, you will get those excellent recipes. But then it'll be like, you know, here's 10 minutes on spatulas. And it's 10 riveting minutes on spatulas.
Have you ever wondered how to save your extra mole? And I'm like, well, no, but I'm a weaker person because I haven't. And, yes. And now I will. And then the other way, it's all beautifully tied to commerce too. Like I really respect it because I would watch something and I'd be like, oh my God, like my garlic press is anemic. Like what am I doing? I have to immediately go on and buy whatever the thing is that they recommended. Like it's 2 a.m. and I'm throwing out all of our condiments because they're subpar. Like so you asked me what got us through. I'm conscious that I sound as crazy as I believe that I have become. But that was a big deal. A quick shift to music, like to the music of this pandemic. I would love to know what you've done, like how you've done it. Mm-hmm. We Brett and I first of all, Dua Lipa is the patron saint of my pandemic survival.
Okay. Like Dua Lipa or Dula Peep?
Well, Dua Lipa, as Wendy Williams once called her.
And, oh, okay.
right. And so the problem is like, I can't make it Dua Lipa. Like the problem, forget what her given name was. So I'll call her Dua Lipa now out of respect. Okay. Full Dua Lipa dance parties here at the house. Boy.
Ugh. Right. I hate that I have missed them.
Right. We should next time we'll FaceTime you.
Oh, that'd be great.
We still have her performance on SNL with the jellyfish hat that will never be deleted from the DVR ever.
No. Absolutely. You will need to go back to that. I love her. I have loved her from the beginning. This was probably 4 years ago now. I went to London and I was staying across from like a mall that was shipping containers. It was one of those kinds of, sure. You know what I mean? Yes. Like all little tiny like burger pop-ups and shoe pop-ups and whatever. And then there was like a sort of common, like a hangout area with an inflatable screen, and they played music videos all day. And the one that they kept playing was Blow Your Mind, Moi, in parentheses. And I was like, the first time I heard it, I was like, who's this ridiculous person and why is she on that TV? And then the second time I was like, okay, this is stupid, but that moi is kind of, it says a lot, it contains multitude.
Yeah.
By the third time I was like, I'm if this person starts a cult, I'm in. I've never left.
All of my things and I will follow her wherever she goes. We have, so we have this, this playlist that my husband Brett started literally, I think March, like that Saturday, March 14th. And just, we've added like, I like that song. I love that song. That's interesting. Where'd that come from? Okay. So it's now cumulatively probably like 14 hours of music that he has. It's called the Stay at Home List. And it's everything from Dua Lipa to like Folklore, which is a masterpiece. Our friend Taylor Swift. But then there's like, you know, the Elite soundtrack. Were you guys Elite? Are you Elite fans?
Netflix?
No.
Oh, gentlemen. Oh.
What? Wow. What have we done?
I don't know what we're talking about.
Well, you've done too little is what you've done. you tonight, today, please, please, please. It's on Netflix. It's called Elite. It is how to describe it. It's the OC meets the Spanish version of the OC. But then there's like murder. But then everybody's having sex at some point, and then there's more murder, but then you're back in high school, and the soundtrack is this incredible, like super like Spanish European infused dance music. And it is embarrassing now that I'm as excited as I am with you, because I'm looking at your faces and I realize that I need to maybe talk to somebody about this.
Not at all. No. I do know what you're talking about. I wasn't associating it with soundtrack. So it took me a minute to catch up.
One Friday night, I'll never forget that we were deep in the pandemic, and we got to it was pretty great. There are these as I said to a lot of people, sort of the beauty and the burden of the past 16 months, right? And one of the beauty and the burden, one Friday night, we would get used to like really long weeks and work really hard. And it'd be Friday night, 7:30, 8 o'clock. And it would still be the two of us. And we'd make cocktails and figure dinner out and all these things. And I came this one Friday night deep in the depths of the pandemic. And I was coming down the steps and I was walking into basically one of the clubs featured in Elite. I was like, wait, what is this music? I know this music. Well, here Brett had like wired into Spotify's Elite soundtracks. And that's what happened here. That's what happened. Less murder here at the house that night, but a lot of SGC.
More SGC.
Great. Just SGC and great thumping dance music. We have done, Mike, and I would urge you to try this as well, is Ben has set up a projection area in the backyard. Amazing. So we would, you would think movies, but we haven't gotten that ambitious yet. Or our attention spans won't allow it yet. Yeah. What we do, because outside has always been a safe place for socializing and whatever. We figured out a way to not isolate ourselves and go crazy. So we have friends over. I figured out how to do a collaborative YouTube playlist. So you show up, you get the link. We all kind of take turns playing things. Everyone has, two or three songs on deck. Or videos, or live performances, or comedy sketches, or whatever. It's the full like video bar experience. It's like the Midnight Sun in the Castro, but in our backyard.
That's amazing.
It is really, really fun. And I'm glad that we had to do something like that. Yeah, it's been helpful.
So cool.
Been helpful.
How do you guys know each other? What is the friendship origin story here?
We met through our mutual friend, Matt Berman, who is a fascinating guy in his own right. He's an architect and designer. And I think he was kind of one of the pioneers of Asbury Park.
Without question.
Yeah. And he and his husband had me and Ben down to the Jersey Shore. And I will never forget this. He was having people over on that Friday as the gang for the weekend gathered. I believe it was for like a circuit party, basically, like the only circuit 100%. Party I've ever been to. It was it was on the beach
that Asbury had ever hosted. It's a bold move, Asbury.
It was a bold move. Yeah. It was a bold move. But as the crowd was gathering that Friday night, I went out. You were talking to Matt by the pool, and something had just happened at work. There was some sort of a something that you had to get involved, and it was a big thing. And I had not met you yet, but I was sort of like on the outside of your conversation, and you explained what you had to do that day. And then you turned to me and you put your hand on my forearm and you said, "I'm a lot." I was like, "Oh, here's my friend Mike. Here's my friend Mike."
Remember that? Oh, Jesus!
Yeah,
oh,
I'll never forget that.
That rings true. Mm-hmm. I remember. So yes, I remember the next day. We were at this circuit party that was, it was kind of multi-stage. It was a multi-stage situation. It was.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Matt, welcome to StockX.
Thank you so much. So good to be here.
Take a look around. I think you'll really enjoy it. We are the only live marketplace for what's now and what's next. Whether it's the latest sneakers, apparel, electronics, collectibles, trading cards, Matt, everything on StockX is brand new and 100% verified authentic.
You just named all the things that I, A, am looking for and B, care about. And the good news is with StockX, you have the power to shop millions of hard-to-find or sold-out products at their true market value. So you can discover products that are on trend, ahead of the trends, by shopping on StockX.
And it's so easy. Just download the app or sign up online to start buying and selling in just a few easy clicks. Start shopping right now at StockX.com. Okay, so just to fill the listener in, a full technological clown show on my end, my laptop just fully decided to become a techno remix. I could see, but all I could hear was a half a syllable from Mike Doyle repeating over and over again. I had to restart. I'm sweating. Then Mike's Wi-Fi went down. We're back.
We've been through something. I do need the people to know that right when we broke, Mike had just started an anecdote at the very beginning of it, and Dave starts reacting to the computer meltdown. But for whatever reason, Mike and I can still see and hear him. So Mike is like, oh, and there's a circuit party on multiple levels. And Dave is like, oh my God. Oh, fuck.
He was more excited. He was more excited in the retelling than he was at the circuit party. Yeah. So he was having a disproportionate reaction to it, which I was like, wait, was I there? Was I there? Yeah. But we're back. Everybody, we are.
We're back. But so yeah, this circuit party was not like a circuit party. We're not talking the black party. No. It's not, you know, no. We didn't go.
I'm not.
It was
in
just
glitter.
A party on the beach.
Yeah. There's no glitter. You're not wearing horns. It was, but this is how I remember. This is the episode that I remember. So it's the day of, it was called Sandblast.
That's right.
Remember? And there's like a sort of a beach thing going on, but you and I and our friends, Ben, my husband, Brett, obviously Matt, the whole crew, we're like on this raised pavilion-y thing.
Yeah.
And I remember looking around and, you know, everybody was jacked and everybody was in like tank tops and everybody looked amazing and hot and everybody was hot and all the stuff. And I looked down at myself and then I look at my new friend Dave and I pointed out to you that you and I were the only two who decided that the appropriate outfit to wear to the circuit party was a sensible J. Crew long sleeve, kind of rolled up at the arms, and a short, and then we were in like, you know, comfortable sneakers because it was going to be a long day, right? Yeah. And so while half the circuit party is essentially nude and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you and I are like maybe ready for, I don't know, the MoMA, you know, or at the very least like maybe a latte. Like at what point did I think a plaid J. Crew was sexy at a circuit party? and yet a love was born, and that was and a love and a brotherhood was born. That's right.
Sandblast, bringing people together.
That
is so correct. It was a lovely time. In that time, since then, you have gotten married.
Yes.
I was lucky enough to be there. Please tell Matt and the world how you and your husband Brett met.
What a wonderful question, because I love the answer. We met, and Dave knows this. We met when we were freshmen at a beautiful little school in Pennsylvania, the place that we were both lucky enough to find ourselves, called Muhlenberg College, in PA. And we met, I don't know, day two or three or something like that. And it's so funny that you remind me that I pointed out to you that I was a lot, because that was, I think, Brett's entire point of view about me for the better part of our freshman year. Muhlenberg's a wonderful little bucolic school, pretty small. You get to know everybody. And we had some mutual friends freshman year. We sort of knew a lot of the same people and we knew of each other. By sophomore year, now I should point out, we were years and years and years. We were a decade away from coming to each of us coming to grips in our own way with how we were made. I was fighting every subconscious thought and conscious thought that I was having at that point about possibility that I was gay. So by sophomore year, junior year, we were incredibly close friends. By senior year, best friends, and that was it. And then we graduated, kind of went our relatively separate ways. I moved out to Los Angeles, and he to New York. But in this super connected group of about 10 to 15 of our closest friends, who remain so to this day, and then I moved back east a year later. We all found ourselves in Washington, D.C. And that was when, a couple of things happened and I thought, oh shit, I can't fight this. This is not something I'm not going to win over it. I'm going to have to figure this all out. And, luckily, I did, but I didn't do it alone. I did it with the benefit of my best friend figuring it out himself too. And so though we chart our, we met in the fall of 1990. We moved to New York in 1999 and got married in 2016. So we chart our relationship really to when we moved to New York and started to figure it all out together. But unbelievably lucky. I don't mean to sound hyperbolic. Like I just don't know what I did to deserve a chance to, meet my best friend and ultimately a guy who would help me through my own journey and his, but to be able to create a life with this guy is an unbelievable, stroke of, good luck, good fortune.
I want to know when you say that his perspective on you when you met freshman year was most likely that you were a lot, what did your allotness look like? What was he getting?
What a great question. The answer to that question is actually rooted almost better in what Brett is. Brett's the guy who looks at a room of 50 people and immediately sizes up the three or four that he's going to spend that night with. Right. He makes deep, fewer deeper friendships. He is so loyal. He's so devoted to the people that he loves and that love him. And he's a guy who still has friends from grade school, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that I share some of that. I still have a lot of friends from grade school and love making friendships that deep. But if I go into a room of 50, I'm going to meet 50 people. And then I'll probably hang out with the caterers for a little while. And then I'll go see if anybody needs anything in the coat room. I'll leave and I tend to sort of be more of a flitter. And I don't often prioritize the things that he does, and God, I wish I did. And that's what I love about him. He keeps me so grounded and he makes sure that I remember what's important and who's important. So I was a lot. I was the, I was always, running for something and wanted to be, starring in some show or giving some speech or something like that. Thinking that would be the only way I could be fulfilled. And he helped me show that that's not the case.
When you say that you two figured it out together once you reconnected on the East Coast, how did that ice get broken?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dave, I talk about it actually in sort of a series of episodes, honestly, that it was for the two of us. The first episode for us, you got to remember we were part of this really beautiful consortium of friends, right? And I don't know how atypical this is. I think this might be pretty common for folks, right? Trying to figure it all out. Part of this big group of 15, 20 friends, inseparable, talked every day, you know, before we even had texting. And it was, we were like a little pack. We just did everything together. And that gave us great comfort, right? I think as the two of us were a part of that, it also meant that we could sort of figure this out, but in a, on a way that, that was supported by friends who were next to us. They didn't know what was going on, and we certainly didn't say anything, but we at least felt like we had that family. Episode one was in, believe it or not, was in 2001. And it was, Brett was going through some stuff at work and 9/11. It was just, it was a bananas time for everybody. And we were trying to figure out, okay, God, what's going to happen if he loses his job and all these things. And we had a lot of quiet conversations about what that would mean. You know, were we roommates? Were we something different? And that was kind of the first conscious thought that that we had. But I was like, shit, I'm not there yet. I'm just not there yet. Years later, in a moment that we would later realize was an actual gift, on some level, we lost one of those people, one of that group, this incredible friend of ours, the husband of our dearest friend in the world, passed away very suddenly. And that was when the two of us, almost without saying the words, we realized, we were 33, we realized, this is it, this is too precious, and we got to figure this out because we could be gone tomorrow. And I sounds super dramatic, right? But I swear to God, it's true. It was just this moment where I thought, Jesus Christ, this is it. And that was when I started to realize, like, I had my first conversation professionally that I can tell you about that was kind of wild. And it was when we started to, we didn't burst out of the closet. We stepped pretty carefully and pretty gradually. But I don't even know if I'm answering your question, but that was the way we did it. It was really together, truly, truly together. But neither one dragged the other. We had a lot of respect, I think, for just the timing that we each needed to figure it out.
It says so much. It's fascinating to me that you have stayed on this journey together, because when I think back to the people that I was close with or the people that I dated when I first came out, it feels like a lifetime ago. They feel like many lifetimes ago. And like, what do you attribute that to?
Wow. His patience. Jesus. You know, God, I think I'm going to sound like a, you know, like a bad poem that you buy to hang on your fridge. But I swear to God, I think it's because we were just the best of friends first. We were the best of friends, and we met at a time where neither one of us had anything figured out. And so we became incredibly close friends at a place that we loved, surrounded by people who loved us. And we were both sort of in this moment where we didn't know who we were or what we were really here to be and all of that. So I think the fact that the journey has been for the two of us really sorting that all out, but doing it together, so I don't know that I've got a great answer for you, other than, you know, we also have such a shared history that's been great, right? We're lucky that our families love each other. We're lucky that our friends are all still really the same. And we've got this incredible family now. Like, I think that's given us a common ground, you know? And also, boy, not a day passes that I don't thank God or whomever that, you know, we still have a blast. We have a blast. And that has never, it's never changed. And we drive each other nuts, and 4 minutes later, we're just laughing our asses off.
And it must have been such a fun wedding after so much time together and such a shared history and shared community. People must have been like chomping at the bit to celebrate you guys.
That's so sweet of you. And Dave can offer his perspective. I'll tell you though, two things that I think made it. Three things actually. One was we went back to Muhlenberg to do it. We were the first same-sex marriage of two Muhlenberg graduates ever in that chapel at Muhlenberg College, which was very cool. The second was we had almost 400 people there. which I don't say, I know it's a little bananas. I don't say that, you know, for any other reason than to say, we kind of went through this conscious moment where we're like, all right, if it's just our families, then it's going to be like 50 people. But my God, we've each got so many chapters, his career, my career, our Asbury family, our New York family, right? And we wanted the whole thing to just be a big thank you note. You know, I can't put all of us in that, but I was, you know, I grew up never sort of thinking that was in the cards for me, that I would ever be, I'd ever live in a society where I could be married, or that I'd feel brave enough to want to be married publicly, or any of those. It just wasn't part of my conditioning. And so to be able to do it, what we both wanted to do was thank everybody that had meant so much to us, that got us to that place. And that's what we hoped that it was going to be. And if we were going to send a big thank you note, you know, we're not going to skimp on that. But I will tell you the third thing that was wild, and Dave remembers this. Our wedding was 1 week after Donald Trump was elected president. And that cast this, it was equal parts, you know, for the majority of the guests, not all of them, but for the majority of the guests, it was equal parts sort of just total sobriety in terms of attitude, not behavior that night, but a total sobriety, right? Just a wake up call. But then also this beautiful, loving defiance that here we were, 400 people in the great state of Pennsylvania that had turned red, and at a time where we had no idea what the fuck was going to hit us in the next 4 years, you know what, for these 3 or 4 hours with this incredible band in this place, we're gonna have a good time, and we're gonna show everybody that love does win. And I really mean that. I think that was the timing of the event could never have been planned or predicted. But I remember that. I'll never ever forget that.
It was so beautiful and cathartic and loving and affirming, you know?
Sounds like the best end of the world party that one could ask for. And I'm in wedding mode now, so I forgive me if I'm asking any questions about this, but I,
oh my God, I'm ready.
Especially that you're getting married in this chapel. How did you decide who was your officiant? How traditional did you go in terms of like wedding party? And
oh, I love that. Oh my God, I'm beaming because I can tell you how great these incredible people were. So we had best people. We had our our family, a guy named Phil, who was my roommate throughout all of college. He would later go on to marry one of my best friends since I was three. Surreptitious moment of meeting, they are now married and amazing and fabulous in all ways. He was one of our best people, and the other was our dear friend Heather, who is she's the third leg to our stool. She's always been there and still is. So they were our best people. We were married by another one of our best friends in the world, a guy named Tommy, and Tommy was the officiant. And we had the God. You're literally everyone has turned off this podcast at this point, I'm sure. The minister from Muhlenberg began the ceremony by sort of giving everybody a sense of place. We wanted everyone to sort of understand kind of that this was the first marriage of a same-sex graduate couple, that just the significance of what that all meant. And then Tommy just stole the show. He's a beautiful writer. He's a brilliant public speaker. He's been like a brother to the two of us, and he was exactly the right person to bring everybody together. It was great. He did a really cool thing that I don't know who's marrying you, but just Matt, if this is ever inspiring, I've passed this on to about 5 different people, and it was all Tommy. I said we wanted this to be a thank you note to everybody. And what he did was he said, you know what, the boys want this to be a thank you note, so we're gonna thank people by making sure people understand kind of the role that they played. And so we're gonna start by thanking the people who were there first. So would all the parents and brothers and sisters, Mike and Brett, stand up and let's give them a round of applause. And then the grade school crew, and then high school, and then college. And let's talk about Mike's work and Brett's work. And so on and on and on. And by the end of the piece, Tommy had lifted everyone up. Everyone was on their on their feet. And he said, now what we're all going to do is thank Mike and Brett for bringing us here with a round of applause. And I could fill up now. I mean, it was, I've never felt, remember that, Dave? Like, I've never felt that sense of community. But again, I will tell you, I think it was catharsis. I think it was just like, you know what? We haven't known how to feel for the past 6 months, right? Or certainly the past week after the events of that election. And I think everybody just felt, whether you voted or whoever you voted for, I think you just felt like, okay, life will go on. We will go to weddings. We will go to funerals. We will go to parties. We will dance. We will drink. We will do all these things. And I hope people felt that moment. I really did.
Let me tell you what I felt. And I think I told you this, but in that moment, at that time in our history, to feel that amount of love from friends, but also from the venue and from the college, and to hear that applause reverberating off the walls of a church, which, I mean, Muhlenberg is sort of non-denominational, right? Or it's not
Lutheran, actually. Lutheran.
It's Lutheran, but it's not like
incredibly inclusive. You know, yeah.
Right. I remember thinking, like, this is how you're supposed to feel in a church. Like, you're supposed to feel held and loved and supported and not judged and celebrated. You know what I mean? Like, you're supposed to be in a community of love and support. And that's what it felt like. And it was really powerful and exactly on time.
Thank you. Thank you. And you know what? Isn't that great? I mean, now, thank God we live in a world that is, I hope, moving closer toward anyone feeling that in any capacity, in any place, right? And so that means a lot. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for sharing and for having us. I want to talk about your career. You are a titan of the public relations industry. You're the CEO of Ketchum. What is it about you that is suited to PR? Why do you think it clicked for you there?
Wow. You know, I happened into this career. I really did. But I think it was certainly, whether it's fate or whatever you believe in. I as the story goes, true story. I was living in Washington. I was interning on the Hill and peddling my resume anywhere that would take me. And I spoke to a bunch of folks that were mentors to me. And one of them, who actually back to Muhlenberg College, where all things begin, a guy named Chris Hooker Herring, who was the director of admissions. And I called him because I had no freaking idea what to do. And he said, Michael, listen, you love to write your, you know, you like to speak public, all these things. And you're really good. It was lovely of him. You're a really good storyteller. I think you should look into public relations. And I honestly, I've joked, like if he had said you're super nimble, you should be an acrobat. Like I'd be like, okay, I'm going to immediately go to the circus. Like, I think I would have done anything you told me to. Long story short, I get an interview at Ketchum, at a place that I, you know, now still love. And they loved me, but I was a day late and a dollar short. They had already hired someone and I missed it. They had already hired somebody to take that job. And about 3 days later, they called me back and said that this young woman ran from the building crying because it was too stressful and she couldn't handle it. Do you want the job now? Of course, I was like, absolutely, sure. You know, I'll take a pay cut. I'll be there in a minute. And I joined it. And you know, I've come and gone. I've left the agency and come back again, and had a bunch of different experiences. But the short answer to your question is, I think that I certainly don't know that I'm perfectly suited, but I think I've been able to find some success, but find enormous joy in a couple of things. I love psychology. I love understanding why people believe or do or don't believe or buy or care about something, whether that's a cause or a product, or a mission, an initiative, a movement. I love understanding why someone cares about that and helping a company achieve their goals by tapping into that. So I love when a client says to us, this is our business objective. This is what we're trying to achieve. Great. Let's talk about why. Let's talk about why do you exist? What purpose are you solving for, or you're filling for that consumer or that stakeholder? And diagnosing it and diagnosing it and diagnosing it and coming back with some beautiful, either big creative program or the most simple strategic recommendation to help a client do great work. And I love that. I love being able to tell brilliant stories for clients, helping them be, you know, their best selves, helping executives achieve their business goals. I love that. And I love that so much of it comes back down to psychology and to that kind of motivation and tapping in to people's why. And I've never lost that. I've always had that. I've always kind of been a diagnoser. I love to kind of keep asking why and driving people crazy. But what I love about it now is that we're in positions, and I'm in a position where we can genuinely help a company tell its story to whatever end makes sense for their business and their people. And that's why I love what I do.
You know, in reading about Ketchum, reading about you, it's interesting. A word that came up in a few different contexts was empathy. And it really struck me because I don't think people associate empathy with PR, but I also think people associate PR with entertainment publicists and the like sort of sharky caricature of a, you know, that breed of human, which obviously you are not. But I feel like a good reflection of, you know, empathy in your work. Can you just tell people about the campaign you did with, was it MasterCard?
Sure.
Your name? Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, I'd love to. I'll talk about empathy though, real quick, because it's just inherent in what we try to do every day. And it happens to be Ketchum's tagline, empathy plus intelligence, because what we think we do best and we strive for every day is to help brands understand what is motivating and what matters to the consumers that they want to reach. And there's no other way to do that than to figure out what a day in the life for that individual looks like. How are they feeling? What's their home life? What's their family situation? What's their whole context, right? And so really putting some discipline into understanding what it's like to be in that person's shoes, and then marrying that with really super smart strategic recommendations that are born of data, always born of data, and figuring out what the solution is. So empathy is a massive part of what we do. And it's big part of how we hire. I love working with the people that I do at Ketchum, because my God, they just show up so human. I mean, at the end of the day, we might be working for a brand like MasterCard, and I'll talk about that, but you know, at the end of the day, MasterCard is a big, beautiful global organization filled with humans, right? In service of humans, right? And so that's just, it's fundamental to the work that we do in communications. MasterCard, probably one of the most important things that I've ever had an opportunity to do, and something Ketchum will be proud of for the rest of time. MasterCard, it's a brand that has long been, I'm by no means an official spokesperson for the brand, but they're one of our most important clients. A long-standing supporter of inclusion in all its forms. MasterCard has shown up for marginalized communities, including the LGBTQ community, for years and years and years. Several years ago, I think it was about 2018, they landed on an observation, and it was a joint observation, MasterCard and their partner agencies, a phenomenal agency called McCann that we work with on MasterCard, that for any member of the trans community, when you apply for a credit card and then ultimately use a credit card at point of sale, that credit card had to have the name that you were assigned at birth, right? Mike Doyle is on my credit card. Well, imagine the horror, the pain, the conflict, the anxiety, embarrassment, whatever the emotion is. If you're a trans person in any phase of that transition of your personal journey, and you show up with a credit card that may appear to be confusing or different at point of sale for the person that you're trying to interact with, horrible, right? And so talk about empathy, right? What must that feel like, said MasterCard. And so MasterCard said, we're not going to stand for that. We're going to create something called the True Name Card. And it was the first ever credit card that could be issued with the chosen name of that individual. It was a breakthrough. It is now represented by so many issuers, Citibank and others. And it was and remains a watershed moment in the trans movement, particularly as it related to what a brand would be doing and how a brand would stand up for the trans community. It's a spectacular example of a brand demonstrating so much empathy that it was willing to make a commercial commitment, the business committed to affecting change for an underrepresented and marginalized community. It remains one of the, you can tell that I get just goosebumps when I talk about it. One of the great privileges of my career to be a part of that.
Yeah, that's a whole other level.
Next level.
Yeah, that's what you do. Tell us very quickly about what you're doing with GLAAD. You are now on the board of GLAAD, Mike Doyle.
I am.
You run the gay community now.
I do. Oh my God, no.
Yeah, no, you do. No, you do. You're at the steering wheel of the gay community now, Mike Doyle.
Don't ever ask.
You're essentially, you're on the board of directors of the gay community.
I will tell you, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic, it is to date the singular honor of, being CEO is right up there, but I can tell you, to be on this board with this beautiful group of people in service of an organization that I have admired my whole life, it's unbelievable. It really is. GLAAD is doing such important work, and to watch the way that Sarah Kate Ellis and her team are genuinely advancing and accelerating acceptance, and doing it through the lens of everything we're consuming, all of the media that we're consuming, all of the content that the world is privy to, the way that GLAAD is trying to help shape it and trying to illuminate the beauty and the horror, right? The incredible work that GLAAD is doing to accelerate acceptance. I am but a spectator, but very happy to be more in the game than I've ever been. I've been on the board now for a year, joined by people from, you talk about titans of industry, just amazing leaders and activists and performers and artists that come together and try to do the good work of this organization in service of our community. It's an amazing honor.
And they are so lucky to have you, truly. Oh, you are a lot.
Yes,
in the best way.
Ask anybody.
Mike Doyle, thank you so much for being here, for doing this, for being you.
Well, for bearing with us through these this technical nightmare. It was worth it.
Yeah, you are
it seems
the greatest.
Fitting. It seems fitting. I am not. I am incredibly humbled by this. And I'm afraid to get your listener results. I'm a data guy, so I have a feeling I'm going to show up pretty close to the bottom of the list. So I'll send it
we
to
don't
my
look
family
at
them. And I'll try to jack it up.
We don't look at them.
No,
we don't look at him.
You guys are spectacular. So, so
you're
talented.
The
it's honor,
best.
It's an honor to be with you.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Now it's me. Fuck.
I hear you.
Fuck.
Oh, we hear. I thought he was reacting to your description of.
So did I. So did
I. God damn it.
I should pause.
Oh, God damn it.
Is he back?
I can't.
So.
Oh my God.
We've got to keep this.